My name is Todd, and I'm an alcoholic.
Oh.
My sobriety date is May the 2nd of 1996. My home group is the Top of the Mountain group in Christiansburg, Virginia. If you're ever there, they meet at 6 o'clock and 12:15 every day. So if you're there during the day, the 12:15 is a great noon meeting. And if you're there in the evening, there's the evening meeting. Check us out next time you're in the area. I want to start off by thanking you guys for allowing me to participate in the meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd like to thank Mike and Noah. Hopefully, what you're going to get out of my talk tonight is exactly what it said it was just read about the establishing the relationship with God. It has been my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous that this is a spiritual program, and I'm going to talk about what that spiritual program means to me. Because when I got here, I can tell you one thing for certain. I had no interest in anything spiritual. Now, what I didn't know then that I know now is I had been living my life on a spiritual basis for a long time. I referred to it as alcohol. From the first drink I took until the last drink I took, it was a spiritual experience for me, and I didn't know that, and I wouldn't have said that to you prior to coming here. I didn't recognize that non-alcoholics, when they drink alcohol, they don't have the same reaction to it that I do. You'll hear people say, oh, they're feeling good when they're drinking. Oh, he's feeling good. That means somebody's been drinking a lot, right? For me, every time I drank, it did that. It was the only thing I knew that made me feel good. And I'm not talking about feeling good as in happy, because not every drunk I had was like that, I promise you. I'm talking about the thing inside of me that I've always had that I didn't know, what to do with. I've always had this feeling that I didn't quite fit in, that I didn't belong. You've probably heard millions of speakers. If you've come to AA for a while, most people say something like that. I just didn't feel like you looked. And no matter what I accomplished, it didn't seem to do for me what I expected, wanted, or thought it was supposed to do for me, except for alcohol. When I took a drink of alcohol, it did for me every single time what I needed it to do. The problem is, it did it so well, I wanted to do nothing but that. And it happened slowly. I didn't make a decision. Oh, I'm going to throw my whole life away and drink. It didn't happen that way. What happens to me is when I'm sober for a period of time, life becomes a hassle. My parents are a hassle, job's a hassle, traffic's a hassle, strangers in the supermarket are a hassle. And if I'm really doing good, everybody but me is a moron, right? Like if I just, I can't, I'm surrounded by incompetence. And that pressure builds. And I can't get life to do what I want it to do. I can't get my parents to act right. I can't get my brother to act right. I can't get anybody to act right. And then I take a drink of alcohol. And I'm not taking the drink of alcohol to solve any of those things. But about the second drink, it solved all of them. My parents weren't so bad. School, I could handle that. Work, I could handle that. You changed. You became bearable. And I could hang out with you. I could be around you. And I didn't even have to know you. You drove better. You behaved better in the supermarket. It didn't matter. And then I would drink a little bit more and a little bit more. And then I needed to be away from you. And slowly over time, I became more and more away from you. But I didn't realize that that was a spiritual experience for a guy like me. I didn't know that that was the spirituality I was living in, before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I just knew that whatever was wrong with me didn't seem to be fixable any other way than getting good and drunk, And the best example I know of that is when I was about 22 years old, about a year before I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. I got sober when I was 23 years old. I've spent more than half of my life as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that was not by design, I can promise you that. But I was about 22 years old, and I was waiting outside a liquor store in Blacksburg, Virginia, waiting for it to open. And I was, anxious. You know how we are? We're kind of anxious, and just time seems to be moving pretty slow. And it opens. I go in. I get the bottle of Jack Daniels, which is always what I got when I could afford it. I went down from there, but I got Jack Daniels or whatever it was that day for me. And I don't remember that part, but I remember this part distinctly, and I'll remember this part probably for the rest of my life. When I walked out of the liquor store, I did this. I cracked it. I instantly felt better. I didn't even have to take a drink anymore. I just had to know the drink was coming. Right? And I don't know how I got there. That was not the plan. But I wound up at 23 years old in rehab. And rehab sent me to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I didn't know that this was a spiritual program. I didn't know that this was any kind of program. I didn't know much about it at all. My parents didn't know anything about it. My mother is 81 years old. She's never been drunk in her life. She's never had more than one drink at a sitting. They had alcohol. I didn't even know this was possible. If they had alcohol that expired in their household because they didn't drink it. My parents are not drinkers. I did not learn to drink from them. But I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, and what I'm going to talk about in the sort of the spirituality of the program, I'm going to use the Big Book. That is the book that I know. That is the book I got sober on. That is the book I still use. So I'm going to refer to it from time to time. The ABCs, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. When I walked in the door, I did not understand what alcoholism was. The definition that I thought, based on the people that I had come in contact with, like most of us do, the psychologists, the psychiatrists, and the school counselors, and the people of that nature, what I thought alcoholism was somebody that drank too much, that stopped drinking, and everything got better. That's what I thought. Now, the problem with that is I can stop drinking. I can stop drinking today, any day. Didn't matter. I can stop drinking. I can't stay stopped. And nobody ever talked to me about the staying stopped part. That thing where everybody becomes a hassle, that starts happening the minute I stop drinking. And nobody ever talked to me about that. What I heard them say is, I just needed to stop drinking and everything was going to be okay. And from their perspective, that's probably true. If you are to ask my parents about my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous, they might actually give you an answer like that. He stopped drinking, he went to Alcoholics Anonymous, and he's done okay. Because they don't understand the rest of it. And so that's what I was hearing when I came in. And that didn't make a lot of sense to me. And the unmanageability of my life was obvious. I was 23 years old. I was about to be evicted from the place that I was living. My parents weren't returning my phone calls, and I was suicidal. I was clearly not winning at life. And the interesting thing is, at that time, I never envisioned myself being this old. I never thought I'd make it past 50. I never thought I'd make it to 50. I just never envisioned a long life because I couldn't pull it together long enough to think that way, And I came in and I didn't really understand that. And I learned the first part of this, which is the physical sobriety. Right? There are three parts that I'm going to talk about. There's physical sobriety, mental sobriety, and then there's spiritual sobriety. The program of Alcoholics Anonymous is designed for spiritual sobriety. So let me define that first. Spiritual sobriety in my life, the way that that works, is when I'm working this program to the point that I don't need alcohol to fix anything. There's no part of my life that alcohol needs to fix today. It does no longer seems like a solution, right? And in the book, it says along those lines, we feel as though we had been placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. We had not even sworn off. Instead, the problem has been removed. It does not exist for us. That is our experience. That is how we react as long as we keep in fit spiritual condition. That's spiritual sobriety. There's nothing that alcohol needs to fix in my life today. That does not mean my life is perfect, far from it. Does not mean that I don't have problems and things that constantly chew in my head that I'm trying to solve, because I think I can. But it means that I'm not standing outside of the liquor store needing to crack the bottle for the only solution I know today. I've been given a set of spiritual tools from this program that has replaced that. You know, the problem has been removed. And that, so that's the goal, that spiritual sobriety. But when I came in, it was physical, right? Physical sobriety. How do I stay stopped? And it says in the big book that that's what the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous is, right? In A Vision for You, it says that, do you have a replacement for alcohol? Yes, we do. It's the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. So when I'm working with a newcomer, before I get them into the book, before I get them into the steps, before I get them service or anything like that, I do what was done for me. I get them the fellowship. I bring them to the fellowship. You know, I met Noah in 1996. We were both brand new. We have been friends for 28 years. We would not have envisioned that when we met each other. You know, but the fellowship, we hung out together. We ate meals together, you know, because I can stay sober in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, no problem. I feel pretty safe here. You're not going to serve me any booze. I'm pretty good. The other 23 hours out there are an entirely different story. And I needed the fellowship to replace my drinking, to get me through those 23 hours until there was the next meeting. And that was the physical sobriety. The problem is some people stop with just that physical sobriety. You know, and I've heard things in Alcoholics Anonymous over the years that I think what people are trying to say and what I hear are probably different. But I've heard things like meeting makers make it. And, you know, don't drink and go to meetings. If I could have not drank, I wouldn't need the meetings. My problem is, I can't not drink. And meeting makers make it is great, except for Noah and I sat in meetings where the person leading the meeting left the meeting and went and got drunk. And she came back the next night and told us all about it. You remember that? You probably don't remember that. But and you know, I knew what we were talking earlier. I had a friend, his name was Scott, and you know, Scott went to between 12 and 14 meetings of AA a week. The longest that I personally know that Scott had sober before he passed away was 2 years. But he started coming to Alcoholics Anonymous in 1992. And the most sobriety he ever put together was 2 years. And he went to meetings 12 to 14 a week. He had the physical part sometimes. But all he had was the physical part, right? He was coming to meetings. He was coming to meetings. You know, he was not drinking and going to meetings, but he didn't go beyond that, you know? And the sort of the second thing that happens a lot in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was talking, I'm really grateful. Mike and Noah drove down from DC. I live in Blacksburg. They drove down from DC. We met in Charlottesville and had dinner. That's Alcoholics Anonymous. That they would give up their Sunday and come meet me that they haven't seen in a while, have dinner, and come to this meeting with me. You know, that was not happening in my life prior to coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. More often than not, nobody would have shown up. Certainly, I would have been a candidate not to show up. You know, you can almost count on me not showing up. But, you know, it's kind of amazing. So, you know, they come down and we're having the fellowship and we're kind of talking about this. Because the second thing that I've seen a lot in my own sobriety is I went through a phase where I thought mental sobriety was it. In the book, it refers to it as self-knowledge, right? And I became obsessed with knowing, understanding all of this stuff. I've sponsored Mike for over 20 years. He can tell you we've been through some intellectual exercises over the years. I'm an avid reader. I love to read. So I've read a lot of things. I still do read. But the thing is, right, the book says the problem centers in the mind. So my mind, which is the problem, can't solve itself. And no matter how much I read, no matter how much I can regurgitate what I've heard other people in AA say, or some book that I've read, or some doctor that I've talked to, or whatever it is, I cannot solve my alcoholism by thought. I cannot think my way out of this deal. If I could have, I would have been successful long before I came to AA because I was trying everything. And I had really good people try and help me. But just like Carl Jung said to Roland, right, you need this spiritual thing. I've been trying to give you the psychological answer. And if you're not familiar with that story, Roland Hazard was sort of the beginning piece in all of this for Alcoholics Anonymous. And he had money, which is always a great thing to have. And so they sent him to the world's leading psychologist, Carl Jung. And he spent a year with Carl Jung, and Carl Jung did all the mental stuff that he could. Sent him on his way. Roland got to Paris. Somebody asked him the wrong question. Would you like a drink? Now, I don't know about you, but I don't think I've ever answered before I came to Alcoholics. I'm certain I never answered that question. No, thank you. I'm not sure. I just can't imagine there ever would have been a time where I'd have been, oh, no, thank you. The answer to that question, of course, is yes. And Roland took the drink and he wound up drunk and he comes back to Carl Jung and he says, what happens? And Carl Jung said, I tried to do all this mental stuff, but you need a spiritual answer. And that was really the beginning of Alcoholics Anonymous in a lot of ways, because then he went back to seek that spiritual answer. And that was sort of it for me. So I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous, when I was in my first year, I went through this phase. I guess it's a phase. It's what happened. My first year of sobriety, I think I got as sick, if not sicker, than I was when I was drinking. And I was going to AA meetings 10 a week at least. And I would go to the meetings and I would shake your hand and I would tell you everything was okay. And then I would go home and I would just gut it out. I wasn't doing well at work. I wasn't doing well in any area of my life. But for the 1 hour I needed to with you in Alcoholics Anonymous, I could put it together enough to come in and tell you everything was okay. And what I know today is if you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, we know already it's not okay. And that's okay, right? I needed to get honest and tell somebody it wasn't okay. And for me, that was at 11 months sobriety. My sponsor picked me up for a meeting and he had the worst car. His car was like, it was all ready to fall apart at any time, but he didn't trust me to drive, which is probably a smart idea. His name was Josh, and Josh picked me up for the meeting. And all I said to him on the ride is, I want to blow my brains out, Josh. I'm miserable. And he did the worst thing. He smiled. I thought, what, like, I'm not happy about this. He smiled and he was like, of course, right? Of course. Because all I had done at that point was go to meetings and not drink, that physical sobriety part. And he said to me in chapter five, there's a line that says, there is one who has all power. And then there's a dash and it says, that one is God. I had lived that my whole life, finishing that sentence, that one is Todd. And at 11 months sober, I had taken sobriety as far as I could on my own. I had to actually start working towards the spiritual solution. Just going to meetings wasn't going to cut it. And so, he said to me, he pointed out that line, and he said, if God has all the power, how much is left for you? I said, well, none. And he said, you know, in Alcoholics Anonymous, we call that powerlessness. And I, you know, okay, you know, that's what you say. Okay, you know, but I had never really, I had heard it. I had listened to it. I'd probably shared on it 1,000 times, right? But I didn't really inside know what they were talking about. You know, and when I sponsor people today, and Mike can attest to this, I say, you know, I can't manage my life. What makes you think I can manage yours? The deal here is that you and I are going to try and figure out the spiritual tools that are available to us so that you can make the next right step. Right? And we're going to figure out, you know, are you being selfish? Are you being dishonest? Are you resentful? Are you afraid of something? Do you need to go make amends for poor behavior? But what I'm not going to be able to do is tell you what to do. Because if I can't manage my life, how am I going to help you manage? You know, I can't do that. But together, we can go through this. And then sort of the lead here is God, right? And it talks about in the book, and, you know, it talks about, you know, that our next step is to grow in understanding and effectiveness. And that's sort of what happens over time as I become more and more effective at using the tools. I become more and more effective at understanding when to use the tools. And I'm really willing to ask for help today. Because I know, again, my brain cannot solve this problem. What seems like a good idea to me, and I promise you, all my ideas are good ideas. I never have an idea and think, yeah, that's probably a bad idea. You know, they all seem like a good. And the worst part about it is some of them actually aren't bad ideas. I'm just self-centered and I don't know which ones are good and which ones are bad. So left to my own devices, I'm going to do a whole lot of damage in between the right ones. And if you came in my path before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I never set out to hurt anybody, but I almost had no choice because I was going to try and force you to live the way I thought you ought to live or force you to help me live the way I wanted to live. And you probably were uninterested in either one of those two things. You know, and it talks about in the third step, we try to wrest satisfaction out of life if only we manage well. And rest means to force. I tried to force satisfaction out of life if only I could manage it well. And at 11 months of sobriety, I was ready to blow my brains out. I couldn't take it anymore. And we're talking about, you know, powerlessness. And so I have to be connected to the spiritual power if I want anything to be different. And so I set out on a course, like I talked about, to mentally figure that out. Right? I wanted to become an expert on this book. I wanted to become an expert. I wanted to mentally figure it out because I was sure if I figured it out mentally, I could just do that. Right? Makes sense, right? Problem, think about the problem, solution, that kind of thing. But that's not how it works for me. Because again, the problem is coming from me. So no matter how long I think about it, I can't come up with the right answer. And I really can't come up with the right answer for you either, because oftentimes, even if I have good intentions, right, the best I can do is point you to the spiritual tools and tell you how I use them. And then it has to be your responsibility to pick up that tool and use it or not. And it talks about that in our book. You know, it talks about it's not giving, it's when and how to give. And fortunately for me, I've been surrounded by people my whole sobriety, right? That it was my responsibility. My recovery was my responsibility. They would show me the tools. We would talk about it, but I had to take the action. No one was going to take it for me. And because of that, right, I started to really experience what those actions meant in my life. You know, I'll never forget the first time, you know, you go to make an amends to somebody. You know, I was sick the entire day. I had played it around in my head so many times, I almost could have convinced you that I'd already done it. because we had had the conversation and we had had multiple conversations. We had had conversations about the conversations. The only problem is they were all just in my head. And of course, the minute I went to make the amends, it didn't go anything like any of the ways I had rehearsed it, planned it, thought it was going to go. But what I took out of that was, first of all, it was okay to be wrong and admit it. And secondly, that no matter how much I thought about something, I couldn't predict its outcome. And I was just going to have a little bit of faith in just taking the action. And you know, I'm sitting there and I'm trying to do this, you know, mental solution to Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, I'm getting the results that you kind of get when you do that, which is I can sound really good at meetings. If I'm sponsoring you, I can come up with, you know, a bunch of things to tell you, you know, but inside, I'm still struggling. I'm still struggling to be honest with you about where I'm resentful, being dishonest, selfish, or afraid, which for me is the basis of what I'm trying to do every day is identify those four things. You know, first and foremost, what am I afraid of? Because nothing drives my life more than fear. I mean, the book says, you know, driven by a thousand forms of fear, and that is absolutely true for me. I'm afraid of everything. I just didn't know that that's what it was. You know, I didn't recognize, because it was all floating around in my head, just how much what I'm really afraid of is not getting what I want or losing something that I think I have. You know, and I'm so convinced of that that it's just constantly going in my head. And I didn't realize that, you know, and so I'm afraid. And the next thing I try and figure out is where I'm resentful. Because that's the thing that takes up the second most amount of space in my head, is I will replay things from 20 years ago. And I'll have the conversation and we'll have a conversation about the conversation and it'll all be in my head. And the thing is, sometimes I'll even change what actually happened in my head to make it more what I think should have happened or makes me look better than what actually happened. You know? You know, they would hurt my feelings and I would want to burn down their house. You know, like I didn't have the connection in, you know, like how wrong I was in situations that didn't warrant my behavior being that, you know, whatever, inappropriate. I didn't really get that. And you know, I what I learned about resentment for myself and is that for me, I know I've let go of a resentment when I stop trying to change or create a better past. It simply is what happened. Could I have done a better job? Sure. Right? Could they have maybe done a better job? Because not everything that happened in my life was purely my fault, but my reaction to everything in my life was absolutely my fault. And I reach a point with resentments where I get to the point where I no longer need it to be any different than it was. And an amazing thing happens. I stop thinking about it. You know, and then the only time I do think about it, I use this tool called substitution. And what substitution is, and this is a powerful spiritual tool for me, when I am in fear or resentment or I'm locked into something and I notice it, I call somebody else. I pray. I go try and help somebody else. Right? I do something other than get lost in the thoughts that are happening in my head. And the sooner I do that, the sooner there's relief. And sometimes, you know, I'm praying and I'm just having basically a conversation with God because I'm locked on something and I'm having a hard time getting it out of there. And I'll do that until I can get to a situation where I can put my mind on something else, you. You know, and your problems, I can't think about mine. And if I'm helping you, I'm focusing on that. I'm not focusing on me. And that substitution works to get me out of that resentment, to get me out of that fear. And then the selfishness, I mean, I try and notice the selfishness, but to be honest with you, it's always selfish. You know, I mean, I have a hard time escaping my own self-centeredness, no matter how hard I try. But what I can do is, again, not get locked up in it. You know, when I notice it, I notice I'm in this position, I can turn my thoughts, I can turn my attention, I can do something different. Right? Otherwise, I'm just sort of lost. I'm lost in thought. I'm thinking about me. I'm thinking about me. I'm thinking about me. And how that usually works in my life is I'll drive past where I'm supposed to go, you know, or you'll be talking to me for 10 minutes and I won't have heard a single word you said because I've been here, you know, and then I'm trying to play that game where I'm trying to like sort of give appropriate enough answers that you'll continue talking and I can act like I knew what you were talking about for the last 10 minutes. You know, and I'm lost in that. And that was the mental stuff that I thought I could fix through self-knowledge. Because see, I know just what I described to you, taking the inventory, knowing I'm afraid, knowing I'm resentful, right? Until I take the next action to take that substitution, to do something different, that self-knowledge doesn't change anything. You know, I've been sober long enough to have moments where I've thought to myself, this is probably not a good idea, and done it anyway. And then had to make amends. Because almost invariably, if I think this is probably not a good idea, it's probably not a good idea. You know, and I've been through that, you know, and I've made lots of mistakes in Alcoholics Anonymous where I've had to go back and just, you know, own up to the mistake. You know, and I started to learn that I wasn't gonna become mentally amazing at solving alcoholism. I needed the spiritual part. And the spiritual part has been very difficult. It has been a long process, you know, and mainly it's because I've had to unlearn a lot of things. You know, there's a lot of things that I assumed. There's a lot of things I thought I heard when I was a kid. There's a lot of things that I think I just made up that I thought was going to make sense, you know? And the first sort of barrier that I came to in this whole process was in the beginning, my relationship with God was a contract in my mind. And here was the contract. I'll do the sobriety stuff, your job to take care of me, which sounds right, right? But the only problem is it was my concept of what all right was, right? So I thought if I'm doing this stuff, basically, I'm going to get what I want. That's what I thought, right? And so the better I got it, you know, sitting in the morning and doing the readings and praying, the more I was going to get what I wanted from my higher power, the more things were going to quote unquote go my way. I didn't realize that's the kind of higher power I had in the beginning, you know. But when I look back in early sobriety, I made a lot of decisions with the assumption that everything was going to work out the way that I thought it should. You know, and when it didn't, I redoubled my efforts in Alcoholics Anonymous. It must be something I need to do different. What never occurred to me is that maybe God's plan and my plan weren't the same. And because I didn't really like figure that out for myself, I would get very frustrated with AA sometimes. I'd get very frustrated with my higher power sometimes because I would feel like, why am I doing all this stuff if I'm not going to get what I you know, think I deserve or want or whatever it was in my head. And I have sort of had that contractual relationship. And I had to move past that, you know. And a lot of that came through very painful life lessons, you know, where I really thought, you know, that it wasn't fair what was happening to me. That just because I'm sober, I'm supposed to be immune from this. And I had to learn the hard way that that's not how life works, you know. And it was not fun to go through that, you know. But I think, you know, what happened is by the time I was, I don't know, maybe 10, 11 years sober, my wife and I were getting ready to move. She got an amazing opportunity, and we were getting ready to move, and we were really going to leave the core that had, you know, held me together for a long time, that fellowship, all those things, And in my mind, this was, happening because we had done, quote unquote, all the right things. And where we thought we were moving, my wife was applying to graduate schools. Where we thought we were moving was North Carolina. We thought she was going to go to the University of North Carolina. We'd gone down to University of North Carolina. We had visited. We'd gone to meetings in the area. We had contacts. We were ready to move. She didn't get into the University of North Carolina. She got into the University of Michigan, which was nowhere on the radar of what we were thinking. And that was tough. That was tough because I had constructed it, right? It was all going to go this way, and it wasn't going that way. And it's worse when it's not about you. This was her journey, and I'm supporting her journey, and I keep wanting to turn it into my journey. Right? I keep wanting to make it about me, but I wanted to go to North Carolina. It's closer to my friends in D.C. It's, all of that kind of stuff. And that's just those lessons, and they seem like, easy lessons, but at the time they were very stressful, because I really didn't have the faith needed, and I didn't know how to admit that to you, that I didn't really have faith that everything was going to work out okay. I had a lot of fear, but I didn't want you to know that because you might tell me, I told you so, don't go, whatever it was. And I didn't feel like as I was in a position where I could accept that. And I couldn't tell you that either. So here I am. I've been sober for a while, and I'm starting to feel disconnected from Alcoholics Anonymous. And I move, and we move to Ann Arbor. And the first thing I do is I go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I just share that I just moved there. And there were people that talked to me, and AA sort of like, started to fit back in the equation. But I ran into a guy, his name is Jim B. Jim B probably has about 60 years sobriety now. He had a lot back then. And he was one of those old timers that comes to meetings and he doesn't share a whole lot, but he'll come up to you after the meeting and he'll drop something on you that you'll think about until next week when you see him again. That kind of guy. And he came up to me and he said, I'm just going to give you one piece of my experience. Forget about how much sobriety you have. Be new again. That's how you move to a new community. Be new again. I called my sponsor. He said it sounded like a good idea. And so I started greeting at meetings and doing all the things that I did when I was new, showing up early and helping set up. Being a greeter at the meeting. And I can tell you, and Noah and Mike can attest to this, I'm not a people person by nature. I'm kind of shy, reserved. For me to greet is almost painful. I don't, it's just not something I would pick to do on my own. I don't know what to say. It always seems awkward, but I was doing it. And I started sponsoring a couple guys in Ann Arbor. And the next thing I know, I've got a little crew. I've created the fellowship I crave in Ann Arbor based on doing the things that created my original fellowship. When Noah and I used to go early and do all these things because we were new and we were crazy. The only difference was I wasn't new. I was probably crazy, but I wasn't new. But I was doing all this stuff and I found myself connected to Alcoholics Anonymous again. And we started a meeting. My wife and I started a meeting up there. And we started a big book because for me, my favorite meeting in Alcoholics Anonymous is a big book study, and it doesn't matter how you run it. I just love the big book because it was written before I was born. It was written by people that I don't believe were capable of writing it at the amount of sobriety they had. And it's written to be a spiritual guide that I can incorporate these principles, these steps in my life. And you can help me do that. So every time I go to a meeting where we discuss the book, I can learn something. Now, that self-knowledge isn't going to fix it for me, but it can point me in the right direction with my sponsor and other people to take the right course of actions. And believe it or not, I've learned some amazing things. There's the line in here where they say that fear ought to be classed with stealing. And I heard a guy say that's because it robs you of everything good in your life. I had probably read that line 1,000 times up to that point where I heard that, and I had never interpreted it that way. And it never dawned on me that that's probably what they meant when they wrote it. I just thought it sounded cool, you know. I just didn't give it a lot of thought. And and so I like book studies. I 12 and 12, big book, but specifically the big book. I just like going through this book. And you know, a lot of times what seemed to happen to me, and this was happening in Ann Arbor, and this still happens today, I would go to meetings and it would turn almost into group therapy, you know, which doesn't matter what the topic is. People just shared about whatever was going on with them. And I'm not against that. I'm not saying that those meetings are bad or anything like that. But here's what a guy like me does in a meeting like that. Check out. I'm now thinking about me. So I'm sitting in the AA meeting and I can't tell you what five people have said because somebody will say something and I'll go into my head and I'm gone. You know, and the topic changes so much, somebody like me can't figure out what we're talking about half the time anyway. You know, and again, I'm not knocking those meetings. They have a purpose and they're there. But for me, for this alcoholic, I struggle in those environments. I need a little bit more structure than that. You know, I need to be in a meeting where I'll hear the guy say that it robs you instead of being in my head thinking about whatever's going on that day because whoever shared before or two before was talking about something that piqued my interest and took me in a different direction. And that can still happen at a book study, don't get me wrong, but it doesn't happen for very long and it doesn't happen very often because there's a focal point. And now that's just my opinion. You know, if you disagree with it, I perfectly understand that. But for me, my experience has been that those ground me. They ground me in a way that I need to be grounded. You know, because again, I'm always looking for that mental first, you know, mental first. And so anything that takes me towards the spiritual is a good direction for me. And so that's what I try to do today. I try to go to meetings like that. And when I do go to a open discussion meeting, and it does tend to go that way, I do my best to just try and focus and, you know, and do what I can, you know. And I, you know, I'm again, you know, it's just my experience that I come to the meetings to meet new people, to try and be helpful, and also to kind of just sort of center and ground myself. You know, I have enough in my head to keep me busy at all times. And if I come in and share what's in my head, and you come in and share what's in your head, and you come in and share what's in your head, that hasn't changed what was happening before I walked in the door. But when I sit in a speaker's meeting or a book study and somebody's talking and there's something going on that changes the direction of my head for a little bit of time. You know, and in my case, a lot of times when I'm sitting in book meetings, it reminds me of how these things have worked in my life. You know, and sometimes, you know, I'll think of something that I haven't thought of in a long time. You know, Noah and I were talking on the way here. There used to be this guy in DC. He came around meetings for a while, and one day I went to pick him up, and it was July, and he was laying in the grass doing this. And when he got in the car, he asked us what we thought of his snow angels. So we knew we were kind of having that kind of a day right off the bat. And this individual had been homeless on the streets of DC for at least a decade. And he'd been coming into Alcoholics Anonymous. He'd been doing pretty well, but there was still a lot happening upstairs. And for whatever reason that day, he was making snow angels in July. And we get him to the meeting, and we're sitting in the meeting, and somebody in the meeting starts sharing that they were struggling to quit smoking. And they were just talking about the struggles and how hard it was. And this guy, he's sitting next to me, and my friend's on the other side of him, and we take him to this noon, and he just shouts out, "Smoke! For God's sake, smoke!" And he looked at us all like, "Why isn't she smoking? This is a problem. Here's the answer: smoke." And it dawned on me in that moment, that's how I think of alcohol, right? You tell me a problem, I think, "Drink, for God's sake, drink," you know? And that's the way I had lived my life. And he was just personifying that in that moment, you know? But for smoking. But I totally get the thinking, right? Like, all the answers so obvious. You're struggling, take a drink. The only problem is for 94% of the people on this planet, that's not a thought that would ever come to them. Oh, I'm having a terrible day. I just need to go get a bottle of liquor and go to jail today. That'll solve the problem. That doesn't come to them, but it comes to people like us. And, thinking about that guy and that experience, is what I need when I come to meetings, is to think, to remember, to be in a position where, I am still learning. What I know today is I've spent over half my life in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been to meetings by grace all over the world. I've had some fantastic experiences, in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'll tell this quick story. I was in Ireland, an alcoholic studying in Ireland. I was studying at Trinity for a brief like exchange period, and I had like a year and a half sober. So, I'm not sure a whole lot of people would have recommended you go to Ireland at a year and a half sober. But they did recommend when I got off the plane before I even went to Trinity to put my stuff down, I might want to go to a meeting. So I did that. And I went to a group called the Molesworth Group. Oddly enough, it's on Molesworth Street. It's about a block from Trinity. I went to the meeting. I met a bunch of wonderful people, and those people really took care of me the entire time I was in Ireland. It was fabulous. And I would travel, and they would oftentimes give me the number of somebody to call when I got to the different city in Ireland so that that person could get me to the meetings. And on my way across, Dublin's on the east side, and I was going to Galway, which is on the west side. I got hit by a drunk driver, and they totaled my rental car. A little irony, I guess. And I had to sit for a day in the someplace I'm not even sure where I was in Ireland, waiting for the next rental car because they just didn't have one that they could give me. So I was pretty shaken up by this, and there weren't cell phones. I couldn't call anybody instantly. I had arranged with my sponsor to call him once a week and write him letters every day that I would mail once a week. And so that's what I was doing. And I was pretty shaken. And by the time I got to Galway, I was very shaken. And I went into the meeting because that's the first thing I've learned to do, get there, go to a meeting. I went to a meeting, and I shared because that's also what you guys had taught me to do. And I said, look, I don't know what's happening right now. I'm pretty afraid, all of that kind of stuff that we share. And after the meeting, this guy, Pat, came up to talk to me. Now, Pat had like the AA starter kit. He was wearing a circle and triangle hat. He had a circle and triangle chain, and he was wearing an AA t-shirt. And I typically would judge people like Pat, like, come on, man, really? But he's the only person that came up to me, and he took me to lunch. And I was living in Washington, D.C. at the time, and he had a daughter that was living in L.A. And he didn't make the connection as to how far that was. And he kept trying to talk to me about L.A. like I knew what he was talking about. And we didn't talk about Alcoholics Anonymous once in the whole lunch. He talked about his daughter. He talked about LA. He talked about what he thought about America. He asked me what I thought about Ireland, all of that. But when I left, I was okay. One alcoholic talking to another. I didn't need to hear a whole bunch of stuff about the Big Book that particular day, I guess, because we didn't talk about that. But we did talk about his life. And I was with another sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it was safe. And when I left that, I was safe. And I've been fortunate to have experiences like that all over. But the one thing that I know for certain is that I have just scratched the surface as to what's available in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm just getting started. Because every day or every 6 months, we used to have this guy, he passed away. His name was Frank. Frank used to say, every 6 months, your life will get measurably and tangibly better. But you don't get to pick the area. Just look back 6 months from right now, and there's a part of your life that's better because you're working the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. But it's probably not the part that you thought it would be or wanted it to be. But it doesn't matter. Your life is better from practicing these principles. And as you do it over time, more and more wonderful things open up to you. But I don't get to pick which part of my life is going to be better 6 months from now. I can hope. But that's not up to me. That's not my job, right? I just keep working this program, and then I can look back and see. And that's what I've learned, right? Like I'm just scratching the surface because every 6 months when I look back, there's a part of my life that has changed for the better. And that's been happening for over 28 years. And I look forward and I see how long I still have to go, how much work there still is to do. And that's how I know I've just scratched the surface. You know, on a good day, I'm probably not mentally altogether. You know, I'm sure if I sat down in a doctor's office on any random day and just started talking about what was in my head, it would end with some, you know, we need you to do this, this, and this. Maybe there's this, you know, my alcoholism has never treated me kindly in the mental department. My head is not my friend. And you know, so I have to go beyond this, the physical. I have to go beyond the mental because, again, my head is, you know, bad neighborhood. You know, I have to stay in this spiritual place. And the cool thing is that there's a line in chapter five, we are not saints. I have no pressure here to become anything more than a sober alcoholic, right? And one day at a time, practicing this program, living this way of life, that's what's guaranteed me, right? To the point that I am sober today because I'm living this way of life. And I'm pretty sure if I live this way tomorrow, I will stay sober tomorrow. I can't guarantee that, but I can't guarantee anything tomorrow. But I can look back and tell you that since May 2nd of 1996, I have tried to the best of my ability, one day at a time, to work the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And since May 2nd of 1996, I've had enough of spiritual sobriety that it has not been necessary for alcohol to fix any problem in my life. And that is what I am most grateful to Alcoholics Anonymous for. That problem seems to be removed. And as long as I come here, it'll stay removed. And if it stays removed, I feel pretty good about my chances of continuing to stay sober. And if I continue to stay sober, I feel pretty good that my life will continue to unfold in a way that I can be proud of, that I can feel good about. You know, I've had a lot of struggles in the last couple of years, family related, with one of my kids. I love him to death. And I've had to change a lot of the way I think about the world, a lot of what my goals were as a person, a lot of things. You know, but that's okay. You know, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous has already taught me that's none of my business anyway. What my business is to show up and be a father today, to show up and be a husband today, right? And that's what I focus on. You know, and I talk to my sponsor and I talk to guys like Noah and Mike, and we work on this thing together. You know, and I hope to be a better husband. I hope to be a better father by continuing to work this program. But most importantly, I hope to be sober one day at a time so I never have to worry about what it would be like if I wasn't. Because I've done that, been there and done that. And you know, I never imagined I would be here. And I'm excited to see what's coming next. You know, and the only way I'm going to know is if I continue to stay connected to you. So I appreciate you letting me come out here. It's always an honor to participate in Alcoholics Anonymous. Again, I want to thank Noah and Mike for taking time out of their Sunday to drive down to listen to me, of all people, talk. I love them both to death. And that is a great gift of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have a lot of love in my life, and I'm grateful for it. So thank you.